I had the opportunity, like many of you, to watch the movie Schindler's List, and it was very poignant, some of the scenes where people were being rounded up and carted away, and it was shocking to see that that has happened in this last century, and you certainly could understand the anxiety of the people that this happened to, wondering, well, what is our future? Where are they taking us? Why is this happening? And is there any chance for escape? And those were questions that were on the minds of many Jews, of course, in the 1930s, as they were taken away from their homes. And as shocking as that can be, that's not the first time that such an event has occurred to the Jewish people. You can go back to 605 B.C. when King Nebuchadnezzar invaded Judea and took over Jerusalem. And when he did that, he had a master plan, as he did for all of the Middle East, because he conquered numerous countries. He wanted to enslave most all of the population and yet take some of the cream of the crop, some of the people, the young people especially, that had promise, that had educational possibility, aptitude, and develop them into regional leaders that would be able to be representatives of the Babylonian government, to control the masses, to be able to control and direct the slaves. And Nebuchadnezzar himself had numerous projects. He's famous for having one of the seven wonders of the world, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. And a lot of this was extensive municipal project development, and it involved a fair amount of money, and it involved a ton of slave labor. And he had grandeur and other plans that he wanted to develop on the backs of the slaves that he had conquered from other countries. So if he had a group of elite representatives from each nationality that would be able to carry out his orders and direct those people, then he would be able to expand his empire. So when the Babylonians swept through Judea, they were looking especially for the youth, for people that were strong and flexible, that they could utilize, develop and utilize in the Babylonian system. And otherwise, everybody was considered a potential slave. If you were in Judea at that particular time, if Nebuchadnezzar was rounding up your family, you would probably have anxiety and a number of questions. And maybe you would be wondering, is there any possible way to escape? What do I do? If I can hold out, do I hoard food? Or do I just give up and quit living? Is it even worth trying to obey God in a time when the country is going into national calamity? Is it the time to collaborate with the enemy? Or do I encourage the people around me that are distraught and worried? You know, God's way works best. What we're going to see today is that no matter what the circumstances, whether the economy is good, whether the economy is bad, whether one's health is good, whether one's health is marginal, whether we have all things or have nothing, God's way is best. God's way works best. It is a phrase that we've reiterated at the youth camps in recent years. It's something that was even born from the early YOU Youth Opportunity United days that we had, that God's way works. We talk about the zone at times, but also this theme is certainly important. God's way works best. It worked for the handful of people that were rounded up by the Babylonians, and it's true for all of us, and it will always be true for all time. If we think back to that particular time, we can consider the fact that very few people were sold on that idea. But yet there were several young heroes of Judea that chose to live God's way. So let us take a look at their lives, and let us emulate their fine examples, and let us understand that in our day today, no matter what we face, or even in current circumstances, or for any other circumstances could ever develop, that God's way works the best. There's no downside to obeying God. There are people that will say, but compromise pays off. Compromise sometimes is situation ethics. It's appropriate. Sometimes, you just can't go all the way with God. But no, God's way works. Let us take a look at the book of Daniel, and we'll look at Daniel himself and three incredible friends that he had, and consider all that was going for them. They were the cream of the crop in Judea. And prior to the invasion of Nebuchadnezzar, they seemed to be charted on course to be prominent leaders of the country. That's what they were groomed for. The fact is suggested that Daniel and his friends were part of the Jewish aristocracy, perhaps had royal blood, and so were in line to be able to have special tutelage even in the court at Jerusalem. We can't prove that, but that's a strong possibility and by several indications in the book of Daniel. It would be as if we had people here that were students that got straight A's out of high school and earned $60,000 or $100,000 scholarships to Harvard University, for example. And upon graduation, they'd be given new Corvettes. They could be the big men, big women on campus. And already know that they would have businesses recruiting them for six or seven figure salaries. The world at their fingertips, so to speak. And suddenly, there's this Babylonian invasion, and instead of having all that handed to you, it would look like it's gone. There's nothing left, and there's nothing to live for, nothing to hope for, no escape. Many would probably become demoralized and be discouraged, and maybe walk away from God. But to keep going God's way, one would have to have, and Daniel and his friends did have, vision and purpose and internal self-discipline. Human nature is prone to compromise left and right. I did a sermon here recently and quoted the book, famous book, The Day That America Told the Truth, and it was quite shocking and revealing what so many people would do for what they thought was a significant amount of money, so many compromises that they would make. Yes, there is a temptation to compromise. And you can read about in the Bible, people like Judas Iscariot, or much of Lot's family, Abraham's nephew Lot. There was a person, Demas, it says over in 2 Timothy 4, having loved this present world, gave up on God. Even Peter, under the disciple Peter, under certain pressure, peer pressure, on the night of the eve of the crucifixion, he was cornered, and they said to him, "Hey, you were one of them. You were one of the disciples. You were with Christ." "I don't know what you're talking about," he said. And so he had to curse and swear and kind of let them know, "Hey, I'm one of you guys. I'm not connected with that." And so we have a history throughout the Bible, even of people that have, at times, under weakness, under pressure, compromised, lied, or pretended, or whatever, that did things that compromise with God's law. And that's common in this world. And it was common in Babylon. People thought, well, if you want to get along, you got to go along. If you want to survive, you have to cut a few corners, maybe tell a few lies, say things that may not be totally accurate, and to go with the crowd. Back when Jerry Lee Lewis was famous as a pianist, we had somebody that ended up coming into the church who was being called about the same time, and he could play this honky-tonk piano, and the people said, you've got a future, son. And so he went to Nashville, Tennessee, and started to meet various music artists and met a number of agents that wanted to sponsor him. And so he looked like he was going to be able to have a career of music there. And when things were looking promising, and he was coming out of a recording studio one day, one of the agents came up to him and said, "Well, kid, I'm afraid to tell you, you can't make it here in Nashville." And he says, What do you mean? This is 1958, not recently. "Well, I don't think you understand, son. If you want to get along with this crowd, you got to go along. You got to make a few compromises if you want to work your way up. You need to loosen up, if you know what I mean. If not, I can't sponsor you. About that particular time, and I think of how God makes a way of escape sometimes for our people, he received the application that he had dabbled around with asking for, application to Ambassador College. He filled it out and decided to go there, and he was accepted, and so he got out of town, out of Nashville. That's not to suggest that every last person that lives there is of a different persuasion, but it was made clear even back in those days that he didn't have a future unless he was going to be part and parcel of the society around him. It's easy to compromise. Kind of like the man that owed tens of thousands of dollars in back taxes. He wrote a letter. He says, "Dear IRS, last year I filed my income tax statement. I deliberately misrepresented my income. Now I can't sleep. So enclosed is another $150 for taxes. If I can't sleep, then I'll send in the rest." Now, people could say, "That's a small sin here in Babylon that I'm committing." But I answer to the king of Babylon now. And so I've painted the backdrop for what we're going to see with Daniel and his friends. And let's go to Daniel chapter 1. You're probably there. Daniel chapter 1, and start in the first several verses here. Verse 1, "During the third year of King Jehoiakim's reign in Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave him victory over Jehoiakim of Judah and permitted him to take some of the sacred objects of the temple of God." The reason that Nebuchadnezzar did that, it was customary to take all the gods, the false gods, the idols of various nations back to Babylon. And the idea was if you could get them, these false gods, on your territory, then they were rendered powerless. And Nebuchadnezzar couldn't see any graven images in Jerusalem. So he said, "It looks like these particular vessels that they use for animal sacrifices seem to be holy to them. So we'll take those." And so they were brought back to Babylon. Verse 3, "The king then ordered Ashpenaz, his chief of staff, to bring to the palace some of the young men of Judah's royal family and other noble families who had been brought to Babylon as captives. Select only the strong and healthy and good-looking young men," he said. "Make sure they are well-versed in every branch of learning and are gifted with knowledge and good judgment and are suited to serve in the royal palace. Train these young men in the language and the literature of Babylon." And that's the way it worked, that people that were brought in were totally immersed into the Babylonian system to dress differently, to speak the language, to get rid of anything Hebrew, to get rid of their old names, to be receiving new names, Babylonian names, and to be fully indoctrinated in every custom of the time. What was amazing with Daniel and his three friends is that they were in the midst of all of that, yet they did not compromise. Kind of like us, in a sense. We know from Passover, when we read the scriptures in John, we are to be in the world without being a part of the world as far as the negative drawbacks, the pressures and the things that could so easily beset us as sin. Yes, we stay within the society in which we live, and we can enjoy the right benefits of that, but not be sucked into all the drawbacks and the degeneracy that seems to be increasingly popular in the world in which we find ourselves. The amazing thing also with Daniel and his friends was they were already convicted prior to the invasion of the Babylonian army. You can't wait until a crisis to know what to do and have the conviction to do it. You have to be fully persuaded and prove it in your own minds in advance of that. Just like the old saying, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And that's on the locker rooms in many athletic section of a high school. And it was on ours. But that's incorrect. It's when the going is easy, the tough get going, the self-discipline gets serious. And Daniel and his friends obviously
had the vision to get serious and be serious and convicted about their relationship with God at an early age, and that had to have been instilled earlier. And if I think of two Proverbs that come to mind, and I'll turn to them. Proverbs 24:10, which is an interesting observation that applied in this case and will apply to us. It says, if you fail under pressure, your strength is too small. The King James, he that faints in the day of adversity, his strength is small. We can't faint in the future. We can't crumble under peer pressure. And the people that were reading about Daniel and his three friends, they stayed the course and they were rock solid. The Proverbs also mentions in 22 and verse 6, it says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's older, will not leave it. That doesn't translate, spank up a child in the way he should go, and when he's 20 years old or 30 or she or whatever, that automatically becomes a baptized member. But it does mean that if you train up a person and teach values and so forth, they will hold on to those in later time. And in many cases, it hasn't always happened, but in many cases, yes, that can also transfer to the second generation also taking an interest in God and the things of God. Where does this instilling or inspiration come from? How is it that Daniel and his friends seem to have that? It may have been through much discussion around a dinner table, or maybe at a school, or with some mentor, some special teacher, or an unusual grandfather or parent or somebody. This doesn't just happen that people go against the tide of degeneracy and paganism and chart out a course against all adversity and against whatever potential persecution there is in order to obey God. It's a remarkable story. In verse 5 of chapter 1 of Daniel, it says, the king assigned to them daily rations of food and wine from his own kitchens. They were trained there for 3 years, and then they would enter the royal service. Exactly what that food and wine is, we don't know. But because Daniel and his friends objected to it, it suggests that perhaps the food was unclean, and the wine perhaps tainted or mixed with something else. They had their reasons. They felt that it was wrong, that it was probably unhealthy. And this was a challenge. Here they had been the cream of the crop in Judah. And after the surprise of this invasion, they were told that they would now be part of the cream of the crop in Babylon, be in prominent position in royal service. And so they had an opportunity or second lease on life. The fastest way to botch that up would be to stand in contrary to the king. And the reputation undoubtedly was for King Nebuchadnezzar that he had a temper, an incredible temper. And frankly, I don't know of anybody that I've ever read about in the Bible or outside the Bible that could get as angry and as quickly as King Nebuchadnezzar. Maybe that's a reflection of other problems. But at any rate, you did not want to cross the king. And for anybody to come up with an idea contrary to the king, put them in his crosshairs. So it was that Daniel, Hananiah, and Mishael, these are the Hebrew names for these three young lads, and Azariah were four of the young men, Daniel plus his three friends. Lest anybody accuse me of not being able to add and subtract out there, were four of the young men chosen, for all from the tribe of Judah. The chief of the staff renamed them with these Babylonian names. Daniel was called Belshazzar. Hananiah was called Shadrach. Mishael was called Meshach. And Azariah was called Abednego. Abednego meant representative of the god Nego. Mishael was representative of a different Babylonian god, and Hananiah was called Shadrach, which also meant something similar. Now, these were all pagan names, But they were to forget everything Hebrew, forget where they came from. They were in Babylon now. And this is the way it was accepted by all the other people, but yet they did not forget their roots, and they did maintain their relationship with their true God. But otherwise, it was total indoctrination here. You ate, slept, dreamt, worked, and went to college totally immersed in the Babylonian culture. The home country, for all intents and purposes, did not exist. The Hebrew past was nothing more than a bucket of ashes. So we can continue to read verse 8. Daniel, though, was determined not to defile himself by eating the food and wine given to him by the king. He asked the chief of staff for permission not to eat the unacceptable foods. Now God had given the chief of staff both respect and affection for Daniel. This is very parallel to the experience of Joseph in Egypt when he was in prison and had grace and favor with the magistrate there. Was ended up being in charge of the jail. They ended up finally then... or even prior to that, getting grace and favor with the Potiphar, who was a captain of the guard of Pharaoh, and then receiving grace and favor from Pharaoh himself. That's unusual, and that's certainly no accident. You have to have character to be able to continually be recognized by the people around you like that. So here, Daniel had unusual respect by one of the authorities that worked for the king. But that particular authority said, I'm afraid my lord the king, who has ordered that you eat this food and wine, you know, if he finds out, he could take my head. If you became pale and thin compared to the other youths your age, I'm afraid the king would have me also, in that case, have me beheaded. So he was saying, I'm just afraid to do this. Not only are you going to be responsible, but I'm responsible too. Not just my job, my life is on the line if this doesn't work. Any other authority probably would have said, Daniel, that's it. You mention that again, and you're going to be in a dungeon somewhere. Verse 11, then Daniel spoke with the attendant who had been appointed by the chief of staff to look after Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So instead of going over his head, he went under his head. But that kept him in safety because he himself was not on the chopping block. So to the immediate supervisor, he said, please test us for 10 days on a diet of vegetable and water, Daniel said. And after 10 days, see how we look compared to the other young men who were eating the king's food. Then make your decision. Now that was an act of faith, because he was counting on there being a difference, a noticeable difference. It wasn't enough for him to say, boy, I feel better on this diet. The other people had to see it and say, there's a difference between these Jews and the rest of the people that are in the accelerated learning program. That way, Daniel was wise. He presented it as an option. He didn't come in there with this holier-than-thou type mindset, thinking, well, let me dictate the deal here. We don't eat this stuff, and we're not going to do that, even though we are here as guests of your country, and this is the way it's going to be. He knew that that would not work. And so he treated the leadership as fathers, a principle we can read about in 1 Timothy 5:1. And there it was. He made his pitch, and the attendant agreed to Daniel's suggestion and tested them for 10 days. In verse 15 it says, and after the 10 days, Daniel and his three friends looked healthier and were better nourished than the young men who had been eating the food assigned by the king. And so, after that, the attendant fed them what they had wanted instead. In verse 17, God gave these young four men an unusual aptitude for understanding every aspect of literature and wisdom. And God gave Daniel this special ability to interpret the meaning of visions and dreams. I don't know what this means in detail. I don't know if he interpreted other dreams prior to the ones for the king. But he was recognized by his peers as being very special. I can't believe that that would ever have happened if he had reneged on his relationship with God. Because when you do that, you can cut yourself off from his spirit. and lose discernment and understanding. Daniel had that, and he was a man, a young man of character, and he did not compromise. You don't read anywhere that he compromised. One of the most exemplary people that we could ever consider at any age. At any age. There's a proverb also, and I'll just quote it, 22 verse 29. Proverbs 22 verse 29 says, "See a person diligent in his business? Shall he not stand before kings?" And not insignificant or obscure, it says in the King James, obscure men. Insignificant or ordinary people. In other words, the individual would be so proficient, so talented, that he would stand before leaders because his talents, his special abilities and service would be in that great of a demand. That seems to be a principle of life and society. It's always existed. There have been people that were exceptional in business that stood before kings. People like Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, Bernard Baruch, all of these people would be consulted with by heads of state, Andrew Carnegie. People diligent in their business, even among athletes. There'll be parties or reception for the winners of the Super Bowl at the White House. Even that's not a business. People that excel at high levels are recognized, and their presence is asked for. Daniel and his group had the opportunity to stand before the king because of their diligence and their hard study, their hard work. Verse 18, when the training period ordered by the king was completed, the chief of staff brought all the young men to King Nebuchadnezzar. These were people that had to pass their graduation exercises and tests, and the king talked to them, verse 19, and no one impressed him as much as Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the royal service. And whenever the king consulted with them in any matter requiring wisdom or balanced judgment, perhaps they could supply raw information that he needed, he found them 10 times more capable than any of the magicians or enchanters of his entire kingdom. Daniel remained in the royal service until the first year of King Cyrus. That was a long time. That spanned decades. So it was that their character seemed to pay off. They had a prominent responsibility in Babylon. They had grace and favor with all of the leaders, including the king. In chapter 2, we read, one night during the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had such a disturbing dream he could not sleep. He called his magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers, and he demanded that they tell him what he had dreamed of. As they stood before the king, he said, "I have a dream that deeply troubles me, and I've got to know what it means." And the astrologers answered and said, "Long live the king. Tell us the dream, and we'll tell you what it means." And the king said to the astrologers, "I'm serious about this. If you don't tell me what my dream is and what it means to you, you'll be torn from limb to limb, and your house will be turned into heaps of rubble." Boy, this guy is very conditional. He can turn on a dime. Oh, you don't do what I say, it's off with your head, basically. And so he could turn. He had a temper. "But if you tell me what I dreamed and what the dream means, I will give you many wonderful gifts and honors. Just tell me what the dream means." Verse 7, they said, humbly and with trembling probably, "Please, your majesty, tell us the dream, and we'll tell you what it means." And the king replied, "I know what you're doing. You're stalling for time because you know that I am serious when I say if you don't tell the dream, you're doomed." I'm reading from should have mentioned this earlier, New Living Translation, just because it reads a little more easily in some of the dialogue. Otherwise, I tend to quote and use the King James Version. Regardless, verse 10, the astrologers replied to the king, "No one on earth can tell the king his dream, and no king, however great and powerful, has ever asked such a thing of any of us. And the king's demand is impossible. No one except the gods can tell you your dream, and they don't even live here among the people." Verse 12, that's all it took. The king was furious when he heard this, and he ordered all the wise men of Babylon to be executed. And because all the king's decree went out, men were sent to find and kill all these people, including Daniel and his friends. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, came to kill them, Daniel handled the situation with wisdom and discretion. Yes, yes. He asked Arioch, "Why has the king issued such a harsh decree?" And maybe if it were anybody else, Arioch would have said, "Don't stall, it's off with your head." But he had respect to Daniel, and so he was at least going to explain. And he told him all that had happened. Verse 16, Daniel went at once to see the king and requested more time to tell the king what the dream meant. Now that would be also risking his life. But perhaps he thought, well, I'll get killed either way. But it was not easy walking in front of an angry king that had the power of manage the world's largest empire at the time. And one little wiggle of his finger and somebody could be, his life could be drastically transformed or ended. But he was able to get permission. Then Daniel went home and told his friends. You know that he would do that anyway because they were so close. They had hung together through the first major trial in chapter 1. They had each other to share with. It's nice when you have a friend or a close associate or several that you can share things, bounce things off of, be able to work with when you face challenges. This is one of the values of Sabbath services, where we can come and we can encourage each other, not forsaking the day of the assembling of yourselves together on the Sabbath, Hebrews 10:25. It's more than just a nice idea. We don't want people to come if they're sick, but to take advantage of the spiritual blessing of being together. It's a synergistic blessing where our interactivity is magnified when we are able to share with each other. So Daniel obviously conversed a long time about the circumstances with his close associates, and he urged them to ask God in heaven to show them his mercy by telling them the secret, so that they would not be executed along with the other wise men. And so they certainly prayed, and they prayed fervently. And that night the secret was revealed to Daniel in a vision. And Daniel appropriately praised the God of heaven, and he indicated that, "Praise the name of God forever and ever, for he has all wisdom and power. He controls the world's events. He removes kings and sets up other kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the scholars, and reveals deep and mysterious things, and knows what lies hidden in darkness, though he is surrounded by light. I thank and praise you, God of my ancestors, for you have given me strength and wisdom, and you have told me what we ask of you and revealed it as the king demanded." So then Daniel had all the confidence to go back to the king. Now, that was not a given that he would have success. Even if he told everything in the dream, the king could have said, "Well, now, wait a minute. You're saying that your God revealed that? Son, do you not understand that you're in the land of Babylon and Marduk is the god, and the god of the moon, and you're snubbing or dissing or disrespecting all the other gods that we have? You're saying that an outside source revealed this to you, when we have at my disposal the best magicians and the best enchanters and the finest astrologers, and you're from this nowhere's country that no longer exists, and you're telling me that?" He could have reacted like that, depending on what mood he was in. This guy was angry at times. So he was walking in there not knowing, but he knew that he had had the answer, and he knew at his young age that if he did not compromise, that he could at least have confidence. And maybe God would spare his life, maybe not, but he could say, "Hey, I guess I'm going down in flames. I'm holding fast to my faith. I'm going to tell it the way it is. I'm not going to compromise." He stood in front of the king, and he was not daunted in any way. He said, "Don't kill the wise men." Oh, anyway, he said to the other authorities prior, "Don't kill them. Let me tell them the meaning of the dream." Arioch quickly took Daniel to the king and said, I have found one of the captives of Judah who will tell the king the meaning of the dream. Now that took a little bit of guts for Arioch to say that. As if this kid doesn't do what he says he's going to do, if he doesn't know, we're both going down. We're both being killed. That was confidence. There was something about this young man that exuded confidence. It was God's spirit. And the fact that he knew what he believed, he represented it. One time somebody made the statement in one of Mr. Armstrong's travels, he said, people of your age, we noticed with other famous people, and we can say it about you, you wear your age well. There was a certain aura or persona, nothing magical, but just physical appearance. It was something, a glint in the eye, the way that he walked, that got the attention of other people, that suggested there is something behind this individual. People could look at Daniel at his age, and because of his closeness to God, they just knew that he was different. I've had people say, I've gone, you know, we were on our way back from the feast. We were at a restaurant, and I saw some people over at this other table. I just knew that they were with us. There's something, I don't know how to describe it in tangible language, but sometimes you just know. And anybody that got to talk with Daniel just knew that he was special, he was different. And if they spent any time with him, they knew he did not compromise. He did not compromise. The king said to Daniel, is this true? Can you tell me what my dream was and what it means? And Daniel replied, and this would be constituted a put down of the Babylonian culture, big time. There are no wise men, enchanters, magicians, or fortune tellers that can reveal the king's secret. But there is a God in heaven. I don't think he was in his face with it, so to speak, but in a kind of a triumphant gesture, there is a God in heaven that reveals secrets, that has shown Nebuchadnezzar what shall happen in the future. And that was very, very strategic to create interest and a little bit of drama. Like, there's a story here, Nebuchadnezzar, and if you don't kill me, I'll tell you what it is. Kind of like the one, the Arabian Nights, this person had to tell the tale to the caliph, and he knew that if he came to the end that he'd be put to death, so he created some kind of interesting plot, a twist at the end that had to be resolved the next night. This went on for 1,000 tales or something like that. Anyway, this was just one day, not a night, and Nebuchadnezzar was interested. Yeah, what will happen? And triumphantly, Daniel said, I will tell you your dream and the visions and what you saw on your bed. And then he goes on to explain in detail about the image, and we won't take the time to read it, but the image with the head of gold, the shoulders of silver, and then the thighs of brass and the legs of iron. And then he said, O king, you are the gold, which was complimentary. That was a quality metal. And after you, another will arise, and there will be four world empires. And it gave some validation to the king. But he was absolutely stunned that this person would know exactly what he dreamed when nobody else could ever imagine. And it did make a profound impression. And the fact that not only did he understand it, he was able to correctly interpret it and spoke with authority and had great poise, that he then, verse 48, was staggered and said that he would appoint Daniel to a high position. He gave him many valuable gifts and made Daniel ruler over the whole province of Babylon, as well as chief over his wise men. And wisely, Daniel thought enough to say, well, if you're going to do that, I have one more request. And the king was just giving one blessing after another. I would ask that you promote my three friends. That was crucial because that put three key people over part of the major part of the superstructure of the government of Babylon. Those were people he could trust. When Harry Truman was sworn in as president, it was a shock to him. You know, Franklin Roosevelt died, and it looked all so premature. And he was out of the dark with a lot of the things going on. He didn't know about the atomic bomb program and other things. But what he did know, he says, I don't know who I can trust here. I need a new Secretary of State. I need other people, other advisors. He was from the state of Missouri. He says, I need to surround myself with Missouri here. I got to have people that I can trust. People will tell me what is going on, not what they think I want to know. I don't want politicians around. I need people that will give me the true story. So Daniel was always wise. Maybe he prayed for wisdom as a child and never let up. But he had special insight. He's thinking, okay, now I'm going to be basically running the kingdom under the king. I have to have reliable, trustworthy assistants. He knew the politics that went on. He understood human nature, and he knew that there was jealousy that would be vented against him. And he had to be as wise as a serpent, harmless as a dove. He had to then interface with the king. It says in Proverbs 20, verse 8, a wise king scatters and winnows all the evil with his eyes. Daniel knew that there was a right way to approach him, and he knew about the temper and the anger, and he had to be careful, and he always was. We move on to chapter 3. We don't have time to cover a lot of that because I want to get the whole span of his life. But chapter 3, verse 1, we read, it says, Nebuchadnezzar made a gold statue 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. An image. This was a foolish idea. Some people speculate that it was going to be designed as a show of loyalty among his people. Some historians suggest that there was a coup against him that failed, and he might have concluded, what a better way to recover my popularity and develop more broad-based support by getting a huge rally around a worship service and having people worship an image that I have ordained to be produced. So he set it in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And he sent messengers to the high officers, officials, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the officials to come to the dedication of the statue that he had set up. So all these officials came and stood before the statue. And then the herald shouted, people of all races and nations and languages, nationalities, listen to the command. When you hear the sound of all these different instruments, then bow down to the ground to worship the image of the king. Anyone who refuses to obey will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. Boy, you talk about zero tolerance. That's it. So I think that it had to look something like Nuremberg, where they had the different rallies in Germany, bringing in the Hitler Youth and the other people that were in the Nazi Party, with all the regalia and flags and 100,000 people in this huge arena, an impressive show of loyalty. Something like that was arranged because it says nationalities represented, and it suggests in this plain an enormous expanse of land that was filled with people. It was a major landmark event. And so, as you can imagine, when everybody, including most all the Jews, decided to compromise and bow down to this thing, that left three people standing that stuck out like sore thumbs. That were the three friends of Daniel. They could have bowed down. It would be easy to say, well, hey, it's just a chunk of metal out there. God will understand. He understands. He understands. My heart's not in this. It's just for now. I won't have to do this again. Just get these people off my back, and then I can serve God. No, there was no compromise. We're encouraged not to just look for trouble. But in this case, it came to them. It was a trial. There was no way out. You either are all for God and none for the devil, as Gerald Waterhouse used to say, or you're going to compromise somewhere. And the three stood their ground. They knew that that was like the equivalent of a death wish, because that would set Nebuchadnezzar into a fiery rage. So the decree, verse 11, the decree also states that all that refuse would be punished. But there are, different people, maybe they were politicians trying to curry favor with the king. They were quick to tattle. They were quick to let the king know. Verse 12, there are some Jews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom you put in charge of the province of Babylon. Ho, ho. Guess what? We could take their place. They pay no attention to you, your majesty. They refuse to serve your gods, and they don't worship the gold statue that you have set up. Boy, they tried to rub as much salt in the wound as possible, make them look as bad as possible. You have to worry about people that are forever deprecating and criticizing others in authority. Man, they're no good. They're no good. And then it's like, huh, but we'll take their place. You know, that's raw politics in the worst kind, first way. They were playing politics. They didn't like these people anyway. They wanted to work their way up the political ladder at the expense of these three. And predictably, verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage, and he ordered these three to be brought before him. And when they were, he recognized them. Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you refuse to serve my gods or worship the gold statue that I've set up? Now, this was unprecedented because of the positive impact that they had on the kingdom. He said, I'll give you one more chance. Now, typically, when the decree was made, so I've decreed it, so it shall be done. That was the mindset, but not here. I'll give you one more chance to bow down and worship the statue that I've made. But if you refuse, you will be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. And then, this was poor statement on his part, then what God will be able to rescue you from my power? If there's one thing that gets under God's skin more than anything else, it's people taunting and saying, if you exist. And people need to be fearful of what they wish for. Now Pharaoh said that, he said to Moses, I don't know your God and what he can do. And then God brought the 10 plagues, which actually were, among other things, a put down of some of their own pagan gods. So here, Nebuchadnezzar says, nobody can rescue you from my power, you know, no other god. And the three young men replied, O king, we need not defend ourselves before you. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us, and he will rescue us from your power, your majesty. But even if he doesn't, they didn't know for sure. We want to make it clear to you, and I think they were respectful here, but this was a bitter pill for him, that your majesty, we will never serve your God or worship the gold statue that you set up. You talk about major defiance publicly, in a public setting, to hold true to their convictions. Again, we can say they did not compromise. They did not justify. They did not panic. They were confident. They were people of faith. And they knew that they had faith in the fact that they were doing God's will. And they were going to let the chips fall where they would. But they were doing God's will. There was no panic. And there was no doubt in their mind that they were doing the right thing. There was a man in England one time by the name of George Mueller who became famous by raising up children's orphanages all over England. In fact, by the time he died, he started in obscurity. By the time he died, he was given a reception at Westminster Abbey in the same manner that Winston Churchill was in Westminster Abbey years later. And George Mueller started out with nothing, but he kept setting aside what little money he had and a lot of prayers for facilities to build, to acquire, and orphans to bring into his care. And many a time, you know, God would intervene on his behalf. It's incredible, the documented interventions for George Mueller. Maybe he didn't understand about God's Sabbath and some of the other understandings that we have, but he acted on what he knew, and he was a marvelous example of a man of confidence. I mentioned that because just like these three men, just like Daniel, he showed poise under pressure. One time he was on the deck of a ship in the Atlantic and on the way to Quebec, and he informed the captain of the ship that he had to be in Quebec by Saturday night to speak at a very important engagement. And the captain said, they were down in the steering room, and the captain says, "Don't you know how thick the fog is?" And George Mueller said, "No, my eye is not on the density of the fog, but on the living God who controls every circumstance of life." He said, "I have never broken an engagement in 57 years. So let us both go down to the map room and pray." And the captain later, years later, wrote this account. He says, "When we knelt down and prayed, he prayed one of the most simple prayers I'd ever heard. And when he finished praying, I was going to pray, but he put his hand on my shoulder and told me not to." And he went on to say, "Captain, I have known my Lord for 57 years, and there has never failed a single day that I have failed to get an audience with the King. Get up, Captain, and open the doors, for you will find that the fog is gone." And the captain wrote, he said, "I got up and I went up the steps and I looked out, and indeed the fog was gone." And later that week, that Saturday night, George Mueller kept his promised engagement. That's not accidental. And I made the comment earlier this morning, prayer should be aggressive. It should have, not passive, it should have destination. It should have purpose, not ramble. There are so many important things to cover and good results to gain through an audience with the King. So we can see back to chapter 3 in verse 28. I'll just summarize. Verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar was so furious with these three men, his face became distorted with rage. Maybe he foamed at the mouth, for all I know. He commanded the furnace be heated 7 times hotter than usual. He ordered some of the strongest men of the army to bind these three and throw them into the blazing furnace. And they tied them, they threw them there, fully dressed. The clothes would surely catch on fire. And in the activity, the soldiers that carried them threw the three men, and they burned up. I know that whenever we've cooked things in the kitchen, especially fish, we'll bake that, and I'm the one that usually reaches down to get it out of the, the furnace, out of the oven. It just hits me, 300 degrees is just intensifying heat. But this was probably a couple thousand degrees, hot as a kiln, and, you know, 7 times hotter if that was literally the case. And that, I just can't help, I always think of the fiery furnace of Nebuchadnezzar when I'm working around that oven. And I think, oh, that was awful. But when Nebuchadnezzar looked down, he saw the three were still alive. They were not singed in any way. Probably almost 50 years ago, we had a church member in Pittsburgh who worked at a steel mill. And there was a huge bucket about this big filled with hot molten metal. And one of the hinges snapped and it broke, and this thing tipped like that, and all the contents came out. Lamp just rained down on a church member. He was almost buried in it. He was not singed, not a hair of his head hurt. And I can only imagine that when they had to file the medical report, you know, for workman's comp, says, "Doctor says, guy is okay, totally healed, back to work within minutes." You know, have to cover themselves. You know, we're not making this up. Come on ahead. Everybody's got to witness what happened here. Highly unusual, but the hand of God is not so small that it cannot save. And either back then or now or 10 years from now, doesn't matter. God has no limits. When Nebuchadnezzar saw that in verse 28, then he did a 180 and he was so just astonished. He said, "Praise to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel to rescue his servants who trusted in him. They defied the king's command and were willing to die rather than serve and worship any god except their own. Therefore, I make this decree. If any people, whether their race or nation or language, speak a word against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, then they will be torn limb from limb and their houses will be turned into heaps of rubble. Well, he's got away with, it's either or. There's no other God that can rescue like this God. Now, in his limited understanding of theology, he probably thought, well, we have a great theology set up. Marduk really helps our kingdom, and the God of the moon is helpful, and the God of the river. But there's this other God. Boy, is he good at rescuing people from fiery furnaces. So we'll put him over here. He's a good God, too. But they didn't understand that he was the supreme God, and all these other ones were not just superfluous, they were worthless. They were non-existent. It was only later, after he went through a spell of insanity, so Nebuchadnezzar did for 7 years, that he came to understand that. We will not take the time to go to chapter 4, so we'll skip that. And advance to the time when Daniel was about somewhere in his 80s. He was an older person. He had still maintained a prominent position in the government of Babylon, but he was not as active when we get to chapter 5. It says in verse 1 of chapter 5, many years later, Belshazzar gave a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles. He may have been the grandson of King Nebuchadnezzar. And he drank wine with them. And he did not know at the time that this was going on that Cyrus was leading a huge army that would overthrow Babylon. Cyrus, and that was actually prophesied by the book of Isaiah. And Cyrus ingeniously decided to divert the Euphrates River that ran right through the city. And that by lowering the water level, he could at night secretly run his army down the riverbed, and they could get under the metal fence and grating that would protect the city, and to get underneath that, and as a result, they would penetrate the city and invade it thoroughly. And there was a false sense of security also, because it was a well-fortified city. It was a city that was many square miles wide. There were, if you can think of the Wall of China, Great Wall of China, it's thick and it runs for a long distance. But this was even as tall and thicker than the Great Wall of China. They used to have chariot races for miles in one straight line. You could have four chariots lined up with multiple horses hauling each charioteer. And you could race around the city all day long. It was that strong of a defense. And so there was this enormous false sense of security that we are impregnable. Nothing can penetrate and take down Babylon. While they were doing that inside, and this party became almost a drunken orgy. Verse 2, while Belshazzar was drinking the wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver cups of his predecessor Nebuchadnezzar had taken from Jerusalem. That was the ultimate sacrilege, to use things, vessels that were considered for holy purpose under the kings and the priesthood of Judah, and to use them in this drunken party. He wanted to drink from them with his nobles and wives and concubines. So they brought the gold cups from the temple, from the house of God in Jerusalem, and they dispersed them to all the people there. And while they drank from them, they praised their own idols made of gold, silver, and bronze. Suddenly they saw fingers of a human hand writing on the plaster wall of the king's palace near the lampstand. There could have been 1,000 people in attendance, everybody having a clear view of what was going on the wall. And the king's face turned pale with fright. His knees locked together in fear, and his legs gave way beneath him. He shouted for his advisors to be brought before him, and he said, "Who can read this writing and tell me what it means? If they can, anybody, I'll dress them in purple robes of royal honor, and we'll give him a gold chain around his neck, and he can be the third highest ruler in the kingdom." But when nobody seemed to have an answer, a clue, it was the queen mother heard what was happening, and she hurried to the banquet hall. She said to Belshazzar, "Long live the king, Don't be so pale and frightened. There is a man in your kingdom, and you don't know this, maybe you've never utilized his services the way others did, a man who has the spirit of the holy gods. What a description. Now, this from a pagan woman who didn't understand the ways of God, but from her own point of view, as best as she could describe it, that has the spirit of the holy gods. And during Nebuchadnezzar's reign, this man was found to have insight, understanding, and wisdom like that of the gods. Your predecessor, the king, your predecessor, King Nebuchadnezzar, had made him chief over the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and fortune tellers of Babylon. This man, Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar, has exceptional ability and is filled with divine knowledge and understanding. He can interpret dreams, explain riddles, solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel and he will tell you what this writing means. What an incredible and acquired reputation. So when Daniel was brought before him, it's interesting, this king said, "Are you that Daniel? You know, one of the exiles brought in by my predecessor? And I've heard about you now. But we can't understand the meaning of these words." And Daniel, he says, "I will give you all these wonderful things if you can interpret that." In verse 17, Daniel said, "Keep your gifts for yourselves or give them to someone else." He could have been political. He could have said, "You know, this is a really, you know, these people really owe me. And this is their time to cash in. And I can milk this. I can extract a lot more jewelry out of these people." But instead of doing that, he says, "You keep all of these items that you want to give me, and I'll just tell you for free what you read on the wall." And when he did, he was risking his life, because he had to tell them their kingdom was going to come to a grinding halt, and they were going to be invaded. And as he did that, they listened, and they might have put somebody else to death, but they took what he said, and the king was still impressed. And so he said, in spite of Daniel turning it down, at verse 29 of Belshazzar's command, Daniel was dressed in purple robes, a gold chain, and was proclaimed the third highest ruler in Babylon. Unfortunately for Belshazzar, he was killed that very night, and Darius took over. When we read in chapter 6, our final passage to assess, Darius had done his homework. He knew how Babylon had operated, and he knew how valuable Daniel was. And so he immediately sought Daniel out. In verse 2, he chose Daniel and two others as administrators to supervise the high officers and protect the king's interest. He knew that Daniel was reliable, because Daniel did not compromise. He had to know that Daniel put his life on the line time and time again to tell the truth, to tell it the way it was. He knew that he was different. He was from Judah. Knew that he would be framed by other people, and that others were jealous. And that he stayed the course regardless and did not compromise with his relationship with God. It says, because of Daniel's great ability, the king made plans to place him over the entire empire. This is in his late 80s. And this continued until he was into his 90s doing this. You know, there are some people that maybe get older and they don't have all, are able to do what they used to do. But Daniel, apparently his mind was just absolutely pin sharp. Makes me think of Charles de Gaulle back in the latter years that he was the president of France. People said, "Well, he's getting old. You know, he doesn't know everything the way he should." And after some embarrassing conversation, a team of doctors went in and started to interview him. And he knew what it was for, and they asked him a ton of questions about the past, details about the cabinet and the government and the wars and everything. And they walked away dumbfounded. This guy remembers and knows everything. He knows it better than we do. So they left him alone. It's sad when there's age discrimination, when it's especially for thinking some people are prematurely unable to do certain things. One man in New York City was fired by the city of New York. He'd been there for a long time. He was 70 years old. He says, I don't want to quit my job. They said, well, we think you're too old. You have to. So he went out and hired an 89-year-old attorney to defend him in court, and they won. They won $1 million from the city, and the city was already in debt back then. So Darius had nothing but high regard for Daniel. Unfortunately, there were jealous politicians that didn't like Daniel, and so they said in verse 5, our only chance of finding grounds for accusing Daniel will be in connection with the rules of his religion. And so the administrators and high officers went to the king, and the king didn't know what was going on, and they gave him lip service. Oh, long live King Darius. We are in agreement, we administrators and high officers and so forth, that the king should make a law that will strictly be enforced. He should have wondered about this. Give orders that for the next 30 days, any person who prays to anyone, divine or human, except to you, your majesty, will be thrown into the lion's dens. Oh, I'm all for loyalty. Boy, this helps me to secure the kingdom. Yeah, I like this. He was too vain to see the real reason. So they kept it going. And now, your majesty, issue and sign us this law so that it cannot be changed, that it cannot be changed. An official law of the Medes and the Persians that cannot be revoked. And Darius signed it. And what that meant was they knew that Daniel had been praying to a different god. And they were going to put him to death, get him out of the way because of it. Verse 10, when Daniel learned that the law had been signed, he went home, knelt down as usual in his upstairs room with its windows open toward Jerusalem. He prayed 3 times a day, just as he had always done, giving thanks to his God. He was not one to get in your face and flaunt religion, so to speak. Neither did he hide it. And he was close to God, and the example he sets of even praying 3 times a day, if we think about it, is, I think, very attractive spiritually, because it's like a clothesline. It can sag in the middle. If you prop it up in the middle, and then at the end, you've got a stronger connection with God. We're so encumbered with our frenetic activity in life that it's a challenge. But that advantage can be ours. And it certainly was for Daniel. But he had mostly control over his schedule. And he gave thanks to God. So the officers went to Daniel's house, as they knew, found him praying, and then they told the king, and told him that Daniel was the primary offender. I'm sure the king was upset with them, but now he was grieved because this meant that Daniel would be put to death. There was no way to revoke the law of the Medes and the Persians, and so it was that Daniel was thrown into a lion's den, and the top of there was a hole over the den that Daniel would be put down in, and then a big stone was to be put over the cover, the top of it. And clay over that, and the king would stamp his ring into the clay. And if anybody tried to rescue Daniel, they would have to lift up the lid and break the seal of the king by breaking the clay. It would be impossible. So Daniel was stuck there until the lions got hungry. As if they weren't hungry already. So the king was distraught. He was very, very upset with everything about this idea. And verse 16, and at last, the king gave orders for his dear friend Daniel to be arrested and thrown into the den of lions. The king said to him, and I think with fear and trembling, may your God, whom you serve so faithfully, rescue you. How odd it is for people to say, you know, you are a man or a woman of God. You know, I admire that. That's a good thing. That's good for you to do. Well, maybe it's good for everybody to do. But it was your God whom you serve so faithfully. A stone was placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed the stone with his own royal seal, and nobody could rescue Daniel. And the king returned. He lost his appetite. He couldn't sleep all night. Verily, early the next morning he hurried back, and he called out in anguish, "Daniel, servant of the living God, was your God, whom you served so faithfully, able to rescue you from the lions?" Verse 21. "Long live the king," Daniel said. "My God sent his angel to shut the lions' mouths so they would not hurt me, for I have been found innocent in his sight, and I have not wronged you, your majesty." And the king was overjoyed. And the king gave orders to arrest the men who had maliciously accused Daniel. So oftentimes people reap what they sow. They always reap what they sow, but sometimes it happens quickly. He had these men thrown into the lion's den along with their wives and children. The lions leaped on them and tore them apart before they even hit the floor of the den. What an incredible impression that would make. And Darius then endorsed Daniel once more and his God, and says in verse 28, Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So, right up through the latter years of his life, when he was in his 90s, he never compromised. He never compromised. He was Mr. Consistency, a person of character. He always strove for what was right. His word was as good as gold. He was always reliable. He was extraordinary. He knew to the value of responding to trials and not running away from them. Even when, humanly speaking, there was no hope, no escape, even when the royal seal was placed over the stone, the secured den, just like George Mueller, he trusted his God. Was he ever lonely? Scared? Doesn't seem like it. Perhaps it was like the little child who was fishing on with his grandfather. They were at a pier, and the grandfather said to the son, "How far do you think we are away from home?" And the grandson, who was about 4, he looks up at granddaddy, says, "I don't know." Grandfather says, "You don't know where you are, huh?" "No." Grandfather says, "Well, it seems like you're lost. Is that right?" And the little guy said, "I can't be lost. I'm with you." Well, Daniel knew he was never lost. He was never alone, not really. What can we derive from these chapters of the book of Daniel? That even in adversity, or when things are going against a person, or politically, or in any other adverse way, God's way works. God remembers his people. He responds to their prayers. He's for them. He wants to turn things around when they need to be rectified. There was a time when Daniel prayed, this is in chapter 10, he wanted to find out the meaning of a dream that he had. And he was so concerned about it that he actually fasted and was going to, he fasted for over 3 weeks. And when Gabriel, the angel, came to him, he didn't say, "Well, you know, we just finally got around to this, like we had to open up everybody's mail before we got to your envelope." No, he said, "You know, from the very first day you prayed, we heard you. But for a variety of reasons, we chose to arrange for the response 3 weeks later, not a day later." There are times when we may seem lonely and wonder, "Well, you know, I did pray about such and such, but it's unresolved." And God could say, or Gabriel or somebody could say, "You were heard from the very first time you gave that prayer. And it's in the works, or it's in the system. We'll deal with it." It might sound like me with this house, but it could be with 1,000 other different concerns that any of us have. And we have concerns over work, relationships, maybe family, over personal things to deal with. You know, God is a powerful God, and he can be there to help, and we're crazy if we don't take advantage of that. And God hears us. It says in 2 Chronicles 16:9, "The eyes of the Eternal are everywhere to see who is strong for him, who he or she is strong and has a heart for God." Is that on our minds? Do we want that in our lives? Do we want to have a relationship the way Daniel had? That's what got him and got the three Hebrew friends of his through the challenges that they faced. And they came through them with flying colors. Let's strive to emulate the good examples that they have provided and realize that God's way does work. God's way is the best way. And God is not mocked. It is the best way. And we of all people should know that and should live that. So let's resolve to do that more than we've done in the past. Not only do we benefit, but our friends and relatives and the organization as a whole is stronger and is able to see more miraculous intervention by a God that wants to bless people that actually believe that he says what he means and that he's willing to back it up. So let's take advantage of that. Let's be the kind of people that God wants us to be, the Daniels of this age, and to make God's way work.